there, and they would not see other cannabis industry people. It was a whole new crowd of undecided voters, soccer moms, older people. He managed to sway, and while I have gotten a lot of credit for my work for Measure 91, I think this man likely is a big reason we got 56% of the vote. So give a warm welcome to travel guru, Rick Steves.
Once again, it's another outstanding feeling that I am, I can't stand it. Want to be down with the day flow, knocking on my door, saying,
thank you very much. It's my theme song. All right. Well, yeah, I had an exhilarating time with Anthony and his crew in Oregon just last year, and the same thing 2 years before that in Washington State with Ellison Holcomb and the I-502 gang. And, you know, we all get the beauty of legalizing marijuana. And I've been at this for nearly 20 years, and I thought I would just share some of my insights politically, because all eyes are on California in 2016. And I particularly am excited about winning here in a couple of years, as I know you guys are. As Anthony said, I'm a travel writer. And for me, high is a place. I wonder, why am I into this? Why do I even care? Well, it's a place, and sometimes I want to go there. You know, my speakers sound better. Suddenly I'm a good cook. Conversations slither around the room like stray cats. You know, it's just sometimes I want to go there, and a lot of people do. And, you know, our government really can't say we can't go there. I mean, there are cases when their government says we can't go somewhere, and okay, there's a reason. But there's got to be a reason, and there's no reason we can't go to that place called high. And I think we're learning that. Now, a lot of people go there, and right now 80,000 people are in jail for exercising the civil liberty to enjoy marijuana, and we're all about changing that. I really believe that the adult, responsible use of marijuana purely for fun, recreational use, is a civil liberty. And I think that's something important. Now, when I'm out in public and so on, I always make it very clear I am not pro-pot. I'm pro the civil liberties to smoke and enjoy pot. Pot is a drug. It can be abused. It can be addictive in certain cases. It's not healthy for you. It's not good for kids. If somebody's caught intoxicated on our roads by anything, they should throw the book at them, as far as I'm concerned. But that doesn't mess up the basic principle, the basic truth that, you know, the right to smoke marijuana is a civil liberty. Now, that's been my theme in Washington, and that's been my theme in Oregon, along with all of our partners in these initiatives, and we're winning. Now, I've learned you have to present it in a certain way. You know, you can't win an election with this crowd here. You guys get it. But there's too many people that don't smoke pot, that never will smoke pot, that need to vote for pot. That's our challenge. So you present it as tax, regulate, and legalize, you see. That makes sense. I know that the laws that we've passed are disappointing to some, and I respect those who oppose it, but we are all on the same team. And the debate is idealism, yeah, ganja's the best thing God ever gave us, or pragmatism. People are afraid of those freaks that smoke that stuff. You know, you've got to deal with that political reality if you want to get anywhere. If you'd rather just be idealistic, well, you can just ignore what I'm saying there, but I'm not spending all this time and money running around to Oregon just to lose, you know, and I hope to come down here and spend some money and time helping out the best I can, but it needs to be something that's embraced. So, you know, the key is to have a public safety law that celebrates civil liberties and to reach those critical voters, the people who actually get out to the polls, which is not our crowd. You'd like to think it's your crowd, but it's not. You can give everybody at Hempfest, you know, all sorts of incentives to vote, and they're not going to vote. But the scared people in the suburbs with kids, they're going to vote. So that's our political reality. Now, to me, this is so exciting because we are fighting the prohibition of our age. History will look back on this and they'll think the prohibition against marijuana was just as wrong-minded as the prohibition against alcohol back in the 20s and 30s. And we've got to remember that you overthrow a prohibition that the federal government is hell-bent on keeping one state at a time. You do it with patience and you do it with finesse. When you look at alcohol, at first it was not alcohol is legal. It is beer is okay in New York. And then they got confident with that. The sky didn't fall, and other states would go along. And then, hey, hard liquor. And then, believe it or not, they allowed people to home brew. But they still regulate, and it goes from state to state how they sell it, where it can be sold. And there's some counties that are actually still dry. And I think that's the way it needs to go with marijuana. We're fighting the same battle, and what we're up against is like $1 billion of government propaganda that has wired most American consumers of media's brains to think that marijuana is the evil weed. Now, there's two energies in this sort of cannabis world. There's the people who are seeing this green gold rush, and I think that's exciting, and I got a sense there's a lot of people going to make a lot of money. And there's people that really are a drug policy reform movement motivated not by starting up a business, but motivated by civil liberties, all right? We are partners in this, and it's so exciting to smell victory. It is so exciting to smell victory. And as we know, when California goes, that's really clearly going to start an avalanche, and that's going to be the end of our war against marijuana. Now, I inject a European sensibility to this discussion because I've spent a third of my adult life living out of a 9x22x14-inch carry-on the airplane-sized suitcase overseas. That's what I do for work. I spend 4 months a year in Europe. I've done that for the last 30 years. Hanging out with people who find different truths to be self-evident and God-given. And over in Europe, a joint is about as exciting as a can of beer. You just don't lock people up in Europe like they do here. Now, it's hard to paint Europe with broad strokes because every country has their own drug policies, and a few countries in Europe are just as regressive as much of the United States, and other countries are very, very progressive about marijuana. But a common denominator, especially in these progressive countries, is something called pragmatic harm reduction. A lot of people into drug policy reform were working on pragmatic harm reduction. It sounds good, pragmatism, reduce harm to your society. That was a catchphrase, and for 8 years of the Bush administration, anything dealing with drugs that had that phrase in it, pragmatic harm reduction, was tossed out without any discussion because that was a sneaky approach to legalizing marijuana. But that's what it is all about in Europe, is helping society. In our society, we measure the effectiveness of our drug programs by how many people do we lock up. Now, in Europe, my friends remind me that a society has to make a choice, tolerate alternative lifestyles or build more prisons. And then they always remind me that we Americans lock up 8 times as many people per capita as they do. Either we are inherently more criminal people or we've got some screwy laws. And, you know, you can make your own judgment on that. But I like a society where drug addicts, and there are drug addicts, there are people that are sucked into the nightmare of hard drug addiction. I like a society that treats those people not as criminals, but as people that need help. And that's what Europe does. And America's coming around to that revelation. When we think of Europe's approach, it is really interesting to talk to Europeans and find out what they're doing, because it's amazing how different it is from country to country. In Spain, they just decided, just grow it at home. Just, you can legally grow a little bit for your own use, and let's keep the money out of it. And people realistically don't want to become marijuana farmers in their own backyard, or they live in an apartment. But technically, you can grow your own. And what the Spaniards do is they join growing clubs, and then they get access to 3 or 4 plants a year, whatever's legal. And then they all get their pot. And when you walk around the streets in Spain, you never see a marijuana shop. You see a garden shop that has all the gear to grow marijuana, and it's the shingle they hang out is a big pot leaf, you see, and it's just, they're selling, it's a Home Depot or something, a garden shop for marijuana growing. Now, when you go to the Netherlands, of course, they have the coffee shop model, and when you go to Portugal, they've legalized the consumption of all drugs, hard and soft, and all for different reasons. When we think about the Netherlands, that's the most famous, the coffee shops. It's really a good test case for legalization, I think. For 25 years, they've had these coffee shops, and they let you sell in a retail way, in a very organized way, not to minors, only so much a day, and so on, marijuana, and they've decided to completely ignore the back end, the wholesaling, the distribution. In the Netherlands, it's called the gray area. One of the most popular coffee shops in Amsterdam is called the gray area, referring to that whole, nobody knows who grows it and how they do it. It's all this little cottage industry. When they have their cannabis cup, they have all these exotic strains, but almost all of them are grown in the Netherlands now. They're really good with greenhouses, and it's just not worth importing stuff from far away because they all grow it there, and they have that cottage industry in the gray area. The frustration for a lot of people who are impatient in Colorado and Washington is, why don't you guys figure out this backside? Nobody's done it before. This is very exciting. It's very complicated. Nobody has had the determination and the patience and the willingness to tackle this thing. It's complicated. And I'm not saying Washington has got it right or Colorado, but nobody else has tried it, and we are learning, and other states are learning from us, and that's the only way it's going to happen. I like to assure people who are afraid about marijuana, because the average voter thinks it's going to be just one big hemp fest when we legalize here, that it can be effectively regulated. If you go around the Netherlands, you see there's coffee shops everywhere not selling coffee. You never see a promotion. You'll never see anything in a window that says, buy two, get one free. It's just not allowed. If I step into a coffee shop, and I do a lot because I write a guidebook on Amsterdam and I have to figure this out, I go in there like a clueless tourist, and how do I spend my money? Because where's the menu? And the guy there says, you have to push that button to illuminate the menu. You know, so I have to take the initiative to push the button to illuminate the menu, and it's only illuminated as long as I keep pushing it. Now that's an example of a kind of legal hair-splitting thing. They can't bring the information to you. The consumer has to willingly get the information in order to consume the pot. You know, okay, that's pretty cool. You know, they have that regulation. They only let you have 500 grams in inventory at a time. They don't want huge business because they don't want to be a distribution depot for France or Germany or Belgium nearby. Consequently, coffee shops have a limit of about 1 pound of inventory at a time. You could sell a ton of marijuana every day, but you have to have shipments coming in of a half a kilo per at a time. The mayor of Amsterdam actually had one of his political agendas was to double the allowable inventory in Amsterdam in order to cut down on traffic congestion. I mean, can you imagine being at that point in your marijuana discussion where you're worried about traffic congestion because of inventory issues at coffee shops? Yeah, we'll get there. Now, one thing they found in the Netherlands is it's just common sense. If all else is equal, you can buy it from a shady-looking guy in the street, and you don't know what you're getting. Or you can buy it from a coffee shop, and he's got a loyal following, and he's regulated, and you know what you're getting. People want that opportunity to consume legally. There's been a little bit of a discussion of rolling back the coffee shop model in the Netherlands in the last few years, and that always gets the media here. Ah, look at this marijuana experiment is failing in the Netherlands. No, it's not failing at all. There's just federal government pressure. There's pressure from other countries that don't like it leaking into their country. There's pressure from the United States because we're very offended by any country that charts a different course. And there are Christian right-wing groups that are pushing the Netherlands. So the federal government tries to roll it back. And who comes to bat for the status quo in the Netherlands? It's the mayors. Because the mayors are the ones that deal with crime on the streets. And they know as soon as you roll back the marijuana coffee shop rules and liberties, you've got turf wars on the streets. And you've got violent crime. In Denmark, they just bulldozed a lot of the marijuana shacks at Christiania. And suddenly you've got gangs out in the streets selling marijuana, and they've had their first deaths in drug little skirmishes in Copenhagen. Unthinkable before, but when it becomes illegal, then you got the crime on the street, and mayors don't want that. So there's basically the rollback was stopped, and the mayors had their way, and the status quo continues in the Netherlands. When you think about European drug policy, a lot of it is motivated by their concern for hard drug abuse. There's a lot of hard drug abuse in Europe, just like there's a lot of hard drug abuse here in the United States. And in Europe, they deal with it a little more pragmatically. In the Netherlands, you had an area which was a no-go zone for police called Zeedijk, back in the old days, in the 70s and the 80s. And I remember looking into Zeedijk, and it was just like all sorts of hard drug addicts and scary, wasted people. And it was just given up by the city. And Netherlands thought, we got to get back this zone. What are we going to do? We've got to think really smart about our hard drug addicted population. We're going to essentially legalize marijuana and put it in legitimate stores, and then we're going to deal with the hard drug problem. And today, a generation later, that same Zeedijk is a gentrified area with all sorts of boutique restaurants and little host hotels and coffee shop on the corner and no more drug trade in the street. And their hard drug addicted population has gone down, and it is getting older. In the Netherlands, 10 or 15 years ago, they decided we're going to legalize the consumption of all drugs, hard and soft. This is what, after you have a dictatorship, they had Salazar running their country for a long time, a fascist dictator. As soon as you get rid of him, you have this hedonistic fling because everybody's going crazy because they got all this freedom. And you get a lot of people messing around with drugs. And he had a little Portugal having a huge hard drug addicted population. And Portugal got together and said, we got to do something really creative and innovative about this. Let's deal with our hard drug addicts by legalizing all drugs. And then we'll turn the government into a friend instead of an enemy of the addicted population. And back then, they had 100,000 hard drug addicts. Conservatives lost the discussion. They didn't like it, but Portugal legalized the consumption of all drugs. 10 years later, they assessed the situation. The conservative government that originally opposed Law 30 was now in power, inclined to stop the law. They looked at the track record, and they had to agree that it was a smart thing. Portugal's hard drug-taking population went from 100,000 to 50,000, cut in half. The marijuana consumption stayed the same. They didn't have the tourism, the drug tourism they feared, and the police saved millions of dollars by being able to focus on serious violent crimes instead of petty drug issues. It was a complete success, and they re-upped it, and they still have Law 30. That's a good example of a track record, and we can draw upon these track records when people are nervous here in the United States. My long-term commitment to this issue is, for me, it's interesting when I look back on it. I just have always felt, I've been doing this for almost 20 years now, and it used to be scary to talk about it. Now it's almost counterculture to oppose it. I remember the old days kind of fondly, because if you just said marijuana, people would freak out. And one thing I was all about was just talking about it. Just talking about it. I've got 20 or 30 guidebooks, and if you look carefully, you'll find the word marijuana in every one of those guidebooks. I just have an ethic to always say the word. With my staff, we all have our favorite gelato flavors in our little thumbnail bios, and for 20 years, my favorite gelato flavor has been ganja. It just causes people to go, what? I remember I went through a stage back in, I think, in the 90s where I just, every once in a while, I had to roll down my window in my office and yell marijuana out the window to my cute little town Edmonds. Just, I was so upset that people couldn't even talk about this. Everybody was smoking it, but nobody could talk about it. Decent people, the people you sat next to in church, the people who were your superiors at work, the people on the radio that you thought were so upstanding, were potheads and good citizens. They just enjoyed it secretly. And I just thought, that's not America. So, you know, about 10 years ago, the ACLU decided to use Washington State as a test ground just to let it be okay to talk about this. And they spent a lot of money making a documentary. I don't know if you've seen it. It's called Marijuana Time for a Conversation. And I got to be the host and help write it. And it was pretty radical just to talk about marijuana. They weren't even saying legalize marijuana. They just say, let's talk about this. This is a big problem and nobody can talk about it. No celebrity would host it. I'm the best celebrity they could come up with. What a pathetic celebrity, a travel writer, a PBS host, you know? So we talked about it. We produced a beautiful documentary, very thoughtful, nothing angry or edgy about it, not advocating anything, just talk about marijuana, to learn about the roots of the prohibition, why did Nixon make it a Schedule I drug, all that kind of stuff. We produced this thing, and the big three stations commercial in Seattle let us run it in the wee hours of the morning after Girls Gone Wild. That's the only time we could run this thing. It was like political pornography to even talk about marijuana. And it was just symptomatic of a big problem where a big problem in our society can't be talked about. Back then I joined Normal, and I'm still very proud to be a board member of Normal. And I thank you. And I think a good thing that Normal does is work very hard to make marijuana palatable to the non-smoking public. To me, that's kind of our theme. We dress nice and we talk to people that normally wouldn't be seeing our side of this, and we promote the civil liberties to smoke and enjoy marijuana. I was giving talks all over Washington State back when Gil Kierlikowski was the police chief in Seattle, the guy who ended up being the drug czar in D.C., and his right-hand man was a guy named Mike Meehan, Sergeant Meehan, who's now the police chief in Berkeley. And Sergeant Meehan was going to all my talks. And they just wanted to know what we're talking about in this drug reform movement. And Mike knew my talks as well as I did. And we became friends, actually. And we'd go out to dinner. And he was a good guy, but very, very buttoned-down law enforcement kind of thing. And one day we were just leaving, having had dinner together, and walking out the restaurant, and he said, he just kind of marveled at how much time and energy I was putting into this when I should be selling my bus tours and making guidebooks. You know, why are you so into this? He said, you're a well-off white guy living in this beautiful, cozy suburb of Seattle. You could smoke pot with your friends for the rest of your life, and there's no danger. We're not going to bust you. And I said, that's the problem. This is a racist law. White rich guys don't get busted. poor people and people of color get busted. And that's reason enough to speak out on this. So, you know, in Seattle, we've been working slow and steady. First, we had campaign, well, I-75. And I don't know if you know about I-75 in Seattle, but, you know, back 15 years ago, the federal government was hell-bent on keeping this illegal. And the best thing we could do in Seattle is say, let's just not change the law, but let's just decide that it'll be our last priority for law enforcement. So when the police have done everything and they've got time on their hands, then they can deal with the marijuana law. So we were accepting the law, making it last priority, and that was pretty radical at the time. And after that, we got into I-502 and then Oregon Measure 91 and California coming up. And I just love speaking out on this, and I speak out on it because obviously we all believe in it, but I can get away with it as a person who can draw a little bit of a crowd because I can talk about it because nobody can fire me, and I don't need to be elected. So it's just nice to be I feel like this is the right thing for me to do because I'm an odd duck that can. Now, once in a blue moon, people will say, okay, you know, fine and all that, but what about your business? Aren't you worried? Doesn't this hurt your business? And first of all, I don't know why you'd embrace a lie just for your business, but just from a very practical point of view, I just have to say, yeah, every once in a blue moon, somebody's going to say, yeah, Rick Steves, I know what you think about marijuana, and we're not going to take your tours, and we're not going to use your guidebooks anymore. All I can think is Europe's going to be more fun without you. You know, so... So it's not been a drag on my business at all. I suppose I've lost a few people, but I've gained more than that because people find it very refreshing that somebody would talk about something they believe in that's just based on a passion for civil liberties. So I want to stress, when you're talking about this, it's drug policy reform. I mean, I don't care if you think, you know, if you're one of the ganja gang that really thinks it's just the greatest thing, fine. But if you want to get the votes, it's drug policy reform. You can present the civil liberties case, you can present legalizing in a conservative framework. You can talk about how it's a costly problem. You can talk about the downside of prohibition. This law is causing more harm than the drug it's supposed to protect us from. You can frame it in fiscal responsibility, well-being of children, racism, all these different things. I think Washington and Oregon were successful. And by the way, we got more votes than Obama between Colorado and Washington 3 years ago, and that was quite a vote of the people. Again, we didn't overreach. We presented it as legalize, tax, and regulate. And my friends in Oregon wanted to frame it regulate, tax, and legalize. You know, but the point is, you wanted to say this is smart law. This is smart law. You stress safety on the road, strict DUI provisions. I like to stress protecting employers' rights to maintain whatever standards they want in their workplace. I know that you have to kind of hold your nose maybe on that if from a certain perspective, but that resonates out there. Yes, employers, they don't want stoned workers. Okay, let them have that right. Protect children, anybody under 21 from marijuana. You have these, you know, private marijuana-only stores that are licensed and inspected and audited, not near schools. You talk about the taxation. The taxation is a huge thing. It doesn't pan out as royally as they usually think, but still, it's tens of millions of dollars that the states wouldn't get otherwise, and this is earmarked for programs that everybody can embrace. Drug treatment, education, public health, law enforcement. It's a beautiful thing, and after a few years, the states are going to get addicted to that tax revenue, and the other side of the tax revenue is freeing up law enforcement not to be tracking down petty, nonviolent marijuana cases, but doing serious, serious work. That really resonated in Washington and in Oregon. I think it's important when you consider your taxes to remember that the more you tax it, they want to tax it in order to tamp down consumption. They want to tax it to generate public funds. But the more you tax it, the more appealing a black market will be. So you have to compromise on your greedy, I want more tax revenue, by realizing if you max out there, you're still going to have a black market in the streets. Oregon learned from Washington's law, I believe, and had a lower tax rate in order to really wallop the black market, and I think that was a good idea. When it comes to home grow, in Washington, we calibrated it very conservatively because we just wanted to win. We felt like we have to win. We have to present a very, very unscary law, and we did not allow home grow. Looking back on it, we won by 6 or 7 points. We could have probably had home grow, but we didn't know how people were going to vote. Colorado and Oregon allowed for home grow, and they managed. A very important thing to remember on these laws is I think you present this conservative law because you don't really know how it's going to pan out, and you trust that the legislator can tweak it in years to come as people experiment with the law and they see how it resonates with the community. At first, people are afraid. What they're going to find is it doesn't change the world that much. That's what's exciting right now about Washington and Oregon and Colorado. The world's not changed. I just had lunch with my governor, Jay Inslee, and we were just marveling at how beautiful it is that in Washington we don't have to arrest 5,000 people a year, and everything else is about the same. It's just not a big deal. That's the funny thing about the Netherlands. The goofy thing about marijuana in the Netherlands is all the tourists are excited about it, and the local people go, oh, yeah, you know, the potheads and the bohemians and the musicians, they smoke their pot down there, but most of us have never even smelled it. It's just not an issue. And that's the beautiful thing. When you take the crime out of the equation, it becomes less of an issue. Now, our experience is that you need to have co-sponsors who are not the co-sponsors you would expect. If you get all the classic gang, you know, in California that's been pushing the legalization all along, that seems natural. But you need to get kind of a dream team of public health officials and law enforcement. And it can happen. In Washington State, we had John McKay. He was the Republican-appointed federal prosecutor. Very, you know, senatorial in his presence. And he would stand on panels with us and just say, the status quo is bad law. We need to change the law. We're demoralizing law enforcement. We had the elected city attorney of Seattle, Pete Holmes. Talk about establishment. He's the city attorney. And that was just a real boon. We had the Children's Alliance in our state supporting us. In California, you've had the NAACP endorsing you. We had church leaders supporting us. This is what you need. And then you present it in a way where people can't cut you off at the knees. I think it's important to remember that when you're debating drug policy reform, your opposition is going to say people are going to start smoking marijuana. And we got to remember, it's not a utopian drug-free society that's an option. There's already a lot of marijuana being consumed. The question is, what's the best way for the society to handle it? You can't wish marijuana consumption away. There's never been a drug-free society. I don't even think I would want a drug-free society if you could pull it off. So remind people when you're debating this that you're assuming use is going to go up. And I make a very clear case that use will not go up when you legalize. It'll just come out of the closet, and it can be regulated and done in a safer way without the black market. So make the status quo really clear. We've had a war on drugs for 40 years since Nixon made it a Schedule I drug. We spent $1 trillion on this war on drugs, and we still have 1% of our society addicted to hard drugs, just like before. We arrest 800,000 people a year. There's 80,000 Americans in jail because of nonviolent marijuana crimes. And we are enriching and empowering an amazing black market. Think of all the money that's being made in the black market that's untaxed and making gangs and organized crime more powerful. And then if you can communicate that and say, wouldn't you rather have legitimate, regulated businesses on the corner that are taxed and manageable? Of course, that's the option that people like. In Oregon, they were arresting 13,000 people a year. In California, I think it's 20,000 people a year. In Mexico, there's been 40,000 or 50,000 people die in their drug war. And it's driven by this manic need to keep marijuana illegal. Now, when I was in Oregon working with Anthony and his gang, a lot of people were saying, okay, your case is good, but let's not rush it. Shouldn't we wait and wait and see what other states do? You know, we've got a track record now. The opponents, that's the only, in a thoughtful community, when you present this correctly, you can't refute the wisdom of taking the crime out of the equation. So I find what they're going to do is say, let's go slower. Don't rush into it. Hey, 13,000 people this year did not get arrested in Oregon because we succeeded last year. That's grounds right there to celebrate what we accomplished. This is important for the United States. I think if you care about our country, it's going to be hard work to take this prohibition down, and certain states will be leaders, and 10 years from now they'll look back and be thankful for that. And we do have a track record. That's the new thing. 2 years now, Washington and Colorado have been selling pot. And the Brookings Institute has just studied it. They're no pushover. And they've looked at all the arguments against it. They've seen the results. And it's clear teen use is not going up. There's no indication of any increase. DUIs are not going up. In fact, fatalities are down in Colorado in the last couple of years. The streets are actually safer since they've legalized tax and regulated marijuana. And crime in Colorado is going down 10%. The only thing going up since they legalized marijuana is tax revenue. And what's not to like about that? So you can make that track record case. Standard questions that you hear is this: fundamentally, use is going to go up. And when we look at track records from any society that's played around with marijuana, whether it's I-75 in Seattle a long time ago, the Dutch, the Portuguese, Colorado, whatever, there's no correlation really between consumption and how strict the laws are. As a matter of fact, by all countries' estimates, our countries and theirs, Europeans smoke less pot than Americans do per capita, and you can do hard time for it here in the United States. And the Dutch smoke far less than the European average. So nobody can really draw a correlation between loose laws, more consumption. I think that's important. A lot of people really believe there's like a reservoir of decent people that would love to ruin their lives smoking pot if only it was legal. And the exciting news is when you legalize, sure, there'll be a spike and then people will settle down. And it's just, I mean, the big difference is now I can keep my bong on my shelf in my living room right there. It's a beautiful thing. I got it there, right next to the flowers and the other stuff. It's just nice to be out of the closet that way. A lot of people have this gateway drug thing. And when I talk to my European friends, they tell me the only thing gateway about marijuana is the fact that it's illegal. Because when it's illegal, in order to buy it, you got to buy it from a criminal on the street who's got an incentive in selling you something more addictive and more profitable. I think the gateway drug is easy. The gateway thing about marijuana is easy to shoot down. A lot of people are concerned about children. It's always, whoa, the children. What if the children get their hands on it? The children already have their hands on it. It is the go-to drug, more than alcohol, in many communities. And we were very strict in Washington and Oregon about access to children. We can't make it so children won't have it, but you can make no case that once we legalize with our laws that children have easier access to it. Of course, there's restrictions on where you can put your stores and how close to schools and all that sort of thing. And the case I made all over Washington and Oregon was we were actually endorsed by the Children's Alliance in Washington State. That's 100 groups whose mission is to protect the well-being of families and children. They debated this thing long and hard, and their board voted 6-0 to endorse I-502. Because the most dangerous thing about marijuana is the fact that it is illegal. Parents know that. That's what you don't want. The worst thing is not having your kid smoking a joint in the backyard. The worst thing is having your kid arrested for doing that, because then he can't get into college. He can't get a loan. He can't get a job. And experts in this game know that the best way to lose control of something is to make it illegal. If you want to control it, you need to control it. Look what we've done about tobacco now with education. I think, you know, underage smoking of tobacco is down 50% or something like that. A lot of people, I hear this all the time, say, it's okay, you know, but it's just the wrong message to send children. The wrong message to send children, because parents can smoke it legally. It doesn't add up to me. The right message to send children is to be honest, and not to abdicate your parental responsibilities, to tell your kids there's certain things you can do when you're adult. You can't use my chainsaw for a couple years, all right? So just come back later. No, you can't drive my car. You got to get a license first. You can't have a cocktail, and stay away from my pot. I found that one thing that really got me going was going to these DARE conferences at school. And nobody could even, you could hear a pin drop. Nobody could even peep a question about the Reefer Madness propaganda that was being said to the teachers and parents and kids. And what that does, I believe, is it really erodes the credibility that parents, teachers, and police people need to help our young people know the dangers of hard drug abuse. It's a serious issue for young people, hard drug abuse. And if all you're doing is talking about the evils of marijuana, kids are not stupid. They're going to write off anything you say about drugs, and that includes serious stuff about hard drugs. So wrong message. I don't buy that argument. The track record, again, for young people is just use has not gone up. We've studied it. Now we've got a track record. And the Dutch experience is Dutch young people smoke about half what American young people smoke, and they can, you know, they've got legal pot down the street for adults. A lot of people you'll hear say, but look at all the kids that are in treatment for drug abuse. And we know that's a dishonest argument. I mean, you go into a juvenile court and they say, do you want a harder conviction or do you want to take treatment? So kids are taking treatment to avoid a more serious conviction. You'll hear pot is stronger than we were kids, so it's a whole different animal. Well, that's a result of it being illegal. I mean, when it comes to recreational drugs, most Americans like their drugs lighter. You know, beer is the most popular alcohol because it's lighter than hard alcohol. During Prohibition, the United States went into it, a beer-drinking society. We came out of it, a gin and a whiskey-drinking society. When things are illegal, they get more potent, and that's just a consequence of the Prohibition. The driving thing is huge, and I just find that you will not get media or thought leaders, civic leaders, law enforcement, you know, any kind of policymakers in favor of you supporting us in California if we don't have strong DUI provisions. And I know that a lot of people were upset with the strong DUI in Washington State, but we needed to do that to get the police to endorse us or not oppose us. A big challenge is just to get these kind of people not to oppose you, and we succeeded in that, and for that I am happy. Now, we do have a track record again. Half of the country has medical marijuana, and there's no statistics that show that DUI rates go up in a medical marijuana state opposed to another one. Seattle, the opponents of I-75 were really complaining about safety on the road. 10 years later, they assessed I-75 in Seattle when they decided not to, you know, deal with pot unless everything else was taken care of. And there was no indication that DUIs went up. So you need to be strong on that, I would say. I've got a lot of friends that just say, Rick, I usually like all your politics, but I just can't do this because I had a friend who was just so messed up with marijuana, and I don't want it to be legal. Well, again, use is not going to go up. There's going to be people messed up with who just they have a character that can't handle marijuana. And I think you can make the case that when you legalize, you earmark tax revenue to fund drug treatment and education programs so people who can't handle it have a place to go. That's a very strong point to make. And when you have somebody messed up with drug abuse, whether it's soft drugs or hard drugs, I like the European approach. In Europe, the word for addicted is the same in many countries as the word for enslaved. These people are enslaved to hard drugs. That's what they are. They don't need cops and lawyers. They need counselors and nurses and doctors. They need to go to the government for help instead of hiding from the government. And that's what they're doing in Europe, especially in Portugal, and it's working quite well. Some people just say, but yeah, we can legalize, but the feds are just going to preempt us. And California's had some bad experience with the federal government that way. And I'll tell you, the federal government just wants laws that are enforceable, I think. They want strict and consistent laws. They want a ship-shaped situation, and they're put in an awkward bind when there are goofy laws, you know, that let you get around stuff. The abuse of medical marijuana laws, I-75 in Seattle, and so on. I'm friends with our governor, Jay Inslee, and I was on the same plane as him when he went over to see Eric Holder right after we legalized. And when Jay came back from that meeting, he said, Holder is most concerned about two things, keeping your marijuana in Washington State away from young people and not letting it leak into neighboring states where it's still illegal. We've solved half that problem now by having it legal in marijuana. We've got to look at Idaho, I guess. That'll be a little while. But they're very worried about this leakage, you know. And I think what we got to remember when we're dealing with the federal government is the federal government is not inclined to say a law that it made and it supports is wrong. But our government is designed in a way where states are incubators of change. And that's how it works. States experiment. If they try to change a federal law and it doesn't work, they just kind of fall back into line. But if they have come on to something and they have can establish that this law is better changed, then other states will pick it up, and it's state by state. As I said, it's incremental. In the case of Prohibition, first it was just beer in one state, then more states, and more different kinds of alcohol, and eventually home brew. Law enforcement just wants smart law. Just a couple weeks ago, I was talking with Mike Meehan, the police chief in Berkeley, and, you know, he knows change is coming. They know it's going to be legal here sooner or later, and they just want a law that they can enforce. That's what law enforcement is here to do, is enforce laws. And they find it it just gives them a bad attitude when there's medical marijuana that is being abused from a medical point of view. And regardless of what you think about it, most law enforcement people just think it's a sham, and that puts them in a difficult position. So when we have a very consistent and easy to enforce and clear law, I think that will get law enforcement behind it. Now, when you look at California in 2010, Washington in 2012, Oregon in 2014, and coming up California again in 2016, I think we've got to consider who opposes legalization of marijuana. It's what I call the PPP, the Pot Prohibition Profiteers. A lot of people on both sides of the issue make a lot of money because marijuana is illegal. And you can say legal, 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 and then when it's almost legal, you look at your bottom line and say, wait a second, let's not go there because I'm going to lose money. We have to be honest about that. There are people that like the status quo because they can make money on it. Big industry, think about pharmacies, think about the black market, think about drug treatment programs, law enforcement. They have a vested interest in this. And everybody who is speaking out against Proposition 91 in Oregon, I felt they were spokespeople. They were being paid for by the PPP. Pharmaceuticals are buying these guys plane tickets to come into Oregon and say, keep the status quo. In Washington State, it was the other way around. It was people to the left of us that were against I-502. It was the medical people, because they feared that it would be tough for their medical status quo and their bottom line. Understandable. But we have to recognize that if we want to move ahead with legalizing marijuana, we've got to deal. We're our own worst enemy is the people who are making money because marijuana is illegal now. There's a lot of money being made in law enforcement, private prisons. Imagine, we have people investing money in private prisons. If you invest in private prisons, then all of a sudden you have a law that doesn't need prisons anymore. You're an enemy of that law. There's a lot of vested interest in locking people up in our country. Sheriff's unions, prison guard unions, police union or police organizations get federal grants. They get to seize stuff and keep it. It's all this status quo. It's the PPP. So as we look at 2016 in California, I hope we can keep an eye on what is our priority here. Legalize marijuana or protect our business interests. There's a lot of good business coming down the road with marijuana, but the initial thing is we've got to get a law that the public can embrace. You can frame this legalization discussion in very conservative terms. The race thing is huge. I mean, it is such an embarrassment, our laws right now. It's the new Jim Crow. You've probably heard about that book or read that book. Very important to realize that this is just a clever way to disenfranchise black voters. 4% of Florida's electorate is black men with records who can't vote. We got 8 years of Bush because of marijuana in Florida. What a clever way, in an age that pretends to be beyond racism, to disenfranchise black votes. I think the NAACP is a smart organization dedicated to the well-being of black communities. They would be predisposed to be hard on drugs because of the way drug abuse has ravaged the black communities. They've thought about it, they've debated, and they realize that the thing to do when it comes to marijuana is to endorse the legalization and regulation of marijuana. That's quite striking that the NAACP would actually come out in favor of marijuana legalization. I believe they did that here in 2010, and they support marijuana legalization in general because they know the most dangerous thing for the black community about marijuana is the fact that it gets their people a record and locked up. From a fiscal responsibility point of view, I mentioned when it's illegal, it just stokes the black market. That's the second biggest cash crop in Washington State after apples, and I know it's a huge deal here in California. And when we can end the black market and take that money out of organized crime and put it into real business, taxable business, that's a good thing. Now, I know that in Washington State, we've saved a pile of money because we arrest 5,000 people less a year. And I was just... I've got a friend, Pete Holmes, who's our city attorney. He got elected in Seattle at the same year that we were discussing building a new prison. Seattle was going to spend $200 million building a prison. Pete Holmes said, if you elect me, your city attorney, I will stop arresting pot smokers and we will put this prison idea to bed and just not build it because we won't need it. Seattleites are not stupid. We saw the wisdom of that. We elected Pete, our city attorney. We stopped arresting pot smokers, and we scuttled the idea of building a $200 million prison, and we didn't need it after all. That's called fiscal responsibility. We can learn from history, and I just think it's so exciting to look at Prohibition and see the parallels here. And, you know, way back in the 1930s, Mayor LaGuardia in New York said, when a society has a law on the books that it does not intend to enforce consistently across the board, the very existence of that law erodes respect for law enforcement in general. Prohibition, where you ignore it and you let certain people get off without enforcing it, it just puts law enforcement and the whole law enforcement situation in a bind. The civil liberties thing, I was having my dinners with Mike Meehan, the Kierlikowski's guy and so on, and he said he disagreed with everything I said in my talks except for one thing, the civil liberties argument. He said, I can't argue with that. I mean, you're right. Americans have the right to do something if it doesn't hurt everybody else, you know? And I just feel so strongly about this. I am a tax-paying, church-going, kid-raising, hard-working American. And if I work really hard all day long I want to go home and smoke a joint and just stare at the fireplace for 3 hours. That's my civil liberty, right? Now, you hear the... just got about five more minutes, but I want to talk about the international dimension to this. Because I'm all into international travel and everything in my work. I just focus on Europe, and it's embarrassing that the United States has created a law in the United Nations, extorted all the other nations to sign it, that requires all nations to wage trade sanction on any law that dares take the crime out of the marijuana equation. Nobody can treat it like a health problem without getting into a trade war with the United States and all of its allies economically. That's radical. And I find that very hard to believe. But recently I was leaving Christiania in Copenhagen. Do you guys know Christiania? It's this squatter community up there. It's just a beautiful little haven. And I was leaving Christiania, and my friend said, be careful with your marijuana here in Denmark, because in Denmark every year we have to arrest a couple of pot smokers in order to maintain favored trade status with the United States of America. I couldn't believe that. And I mean, I've talked to other guys who are really more wonky about this, and it's absolutely true. Our government is so hell-bent on keeping this thing criminal, and that's why we hear the word decriminalize rather than legalize. When a country decriminalizes, it's just a legal fine point, because if they legalize, they're in trouble. Now, with four states having marijuana actually legal, it's very tough for the United States to stand up against other countries and say, you can't do it either, you see, because we're doing it right here within our own family. Uruguay is legalizing, I understand. Jamaica's about to do that. There's lots of countries now that are going to have more freedom because of the work we've done here. Little by little, Washington, Colorado, Alaska, Oregon, California. All right. So, 2016 is the year for California. It's all hands on deck. When you look at the history, it's kind of a cool evolution. In the 1990s, Washington, Oregon, California, Alaska wanted medical pot. The federal government said no. The politicians didn't have the nerve to go against it. So it had to go to the initiative process. That's what you do when the politicians are afraid to touch it. Initiative, and it passed. Since then, half the country has followed, and the feds have generally allowed it. And I want to stress, I believe they bust California because they don't like the sloppiness of the California situation. Colorado did not get as much attention from the federal government because it's a little more ship-shape. So we have to respect that need from the federal government, I think. Now, a generation later, we have the same cycle going on. People want to legalize, tax, and regulate. And it's the same states that are leading the charge. California really broke the mold in 2010 with that valiant effort. 2012, we learned a little bit about that, and Colorado and Washington had those law enforcement public safety kind of laws, and we got more votes than Obama. 2014, it was a difficult year because it was not a presidential year, and Oregon and Alaska still tried it and did a beautiful job. And won, even on an off year when you get older, more conservative people voting, that bodes very well for the momentum of our movement, and it looks great for California. It'll be a presidential year. There's a lot of big money ready to come in and support, especially if it's a public safety law. I'm going to support it if it's a public safety law that in law enforcement can endorse and the non-smokers can endorse. If it's a pro-pot law, I'm not going to, I just can't support it, you know, and nor can a lot of other players. It will evolve. Everybody will get comfortable with marijuana over time. But right now, I believe we have to be pragmatic, and we have to be real about actually not being scary in the suburbs and winning it. I'm very satisfied in my state the way it is evolving gradually. I know there's a lot of people in the cannabis industry that are a little bit frustrated, but with patience, we're going to get there. And in my normal circle of friends, we are just astounded at how fast things are going. Things are going very fast, and that's exciting. So I hope that we can focus on the drug policy reform idea, that we can present it in a way where it's good citizenship to tackle a law that is a problem and counterproductive. And I'm pretty confident that Californian voters will see it this way. I think that when California recognizes the civil liberty of enjoying marijuana, you will then have a community that can be not necessarily hard on drugs or soft on drugs, but a community that is smart with drugs. Okay? Thank you very much. And as I like to say, happy travels.
Rick Steves.
Even if you're just staying home. Thank you.
Rick Steves, one more time. Rick Steves. Do you have time for maybe two questions?
Yeah.